For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. Like most GPs, Associate Professor Louise Stone has had a stressful year. Apart from the long-running pressures of underfunding, poor communication from governments and the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, 2022 has been characterised by two big attacks on general practice. The first came from a group of psychiatrists who accused GPs of being gatekeepers who were hampering the mental health treatment of some patients for the sake of their revenue. The second was the so-called Medicare rort scandal, when GPs were targeted as being mainly responsible for the defrauding of Medicare to the tune of $8 billion. Those claims have since been debunked, but the damage has been done, with many GPs exhausted by the constant devaluing of what they do. Louise Stone has been vocal throughout all these attacks, standing up for herself and her GP colleagues through media statements, including articles for Insight Plus, and through her Twitter account, GP Swamp Warrior. Today, in our last episode of Voice of the GP for the year, Louise is my special guest. So I wanted to talk to you about why you got into GP and how you're going, given the year. So let's start at the beginning. Was medicine always something you were aiming at?
No, I didn't want to become a doctor. I wanted to become a vet until year 11. I'm afraid James Herriot was my favourite person ever, and I was determined to become a vet. It was a difficult decision to do medicine, actually, because no one in my family had ever been to university. And in order to get to university, there was one scholarship available in Wollongong. That was it. That's where I grew up. So I had to work incredibly hard, ridiculously hard, to try and earn that scholarship, because that was my only chance at getting into medicine at the time, into Sydney University. And I chose Sydney University partly because it let me do a psychology degree at night. I don't know why I chose to do both degrees together, but I did. Leading to a very unusual circumstance where I had to imprint chickens. And I'll never forget being the meek person, unbelievably, that I was then, having two newly born chickens in my pockets while I was trying to do a histology prac with a very, very disciplinarian tutor, and thinking, please don't cheap. Please don't cheap. Thinking it's so bizarre that no one will ever believe me. So yes.
And did you successfully imprint upon the chooks?
I did imprint the chickens. Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so you got into med. When did general practice loom its head?
Yeah, surprisingly, I look back now and I'm not really sure why, but I found medicine very difficult. Obviously, like most of us, I was a good student. I mean, you sort of have to be. Mm. Partly, I think I had glandular fever in second year, which made me very sick.
Oh, yeah.
Found medicine very difficult. When I look back now, I think it was partly cultural. I think having grown up in a, you know, fairly working class community, I think that transition to Sydney University was very, very hard. And general practice was the only thing I was good at. You know, I sort of conceded pass and passed my way through medicine, and then won a medal and a high distinction in general practice, and then went back to passes and sort of went, well, I guess that's where I want to be then. And when I think back, it makes sense in that, you know, I am a big picture thinker, and that made a lot of sense. And my first job in my intern year, I actually went out to Broken Hill and worked in Broken Hill, and actually worked for a while with the Flying Doctor Service, and went out to the nurses and said, I know nothing. Sydney University taught me nothing practical. Help me. And they did, and taught me how to inject things and do plasters and all the useful things that I never learned at uni. Always been grateful to them because it gave me a sense of great perspective. You know, I know what serious is and this isn't it. And just the courage to try things. I'm not an intuitive proceduralist, and I was very meek. I wasn't very brave in those days. And I think having been out to, you know, the outback and worked with the Flying Doctor Service, I think gave me a lot of courage, and that helped me to refine my ideas of wanting to work rural. And that was really, by the time I got back from Broken Hill, that was the goal, is to work rural.
So how do you end up at ANU as a GP clinician researcher, essentially, academic? So where did the academic stuff come in?
I started my Masters of Public Health when I was in my intern year. I don't know why. I think part of it was I wasn't very confident and I thought if I had more skills it would help. I'm not sure that the Masters of Public Health did that. But by the time I was in a little country town in Victoria where I did most of my general practice training, I was the only female GP within 3 hours. I ended up finishing my Masters of Public Health with Monash, and then Monash tapped me to start lecturing, and I ended up running their Masters of GP Psychiatry in my 20s. I got relocated to Sydney when my youngest daughter needed tertiary hospital care, and that was quite quick. It was very sad, you know, to leave all that behind because that had been the goal for me to work rural, but I needed a tertiary hospital around the corner. I had 3 little kids. And I ended up in medical education teaching GP registrars fairly quickly after that, partly, I think, because I like teaching, but also partly because my daughter has a very serious chronic illness, and so she was in and out of hospital all the time. And trying to run a clinic in that sort of context is very difficult, whereas most educational things, unless you're not in front of a group, can be deferred or delayed, or we can work around it. So yes, that's where the medical education came up, and I ended up being the senior medical advisor for GP training in Australia for about 10 years. And that meant 3 days a fortnight in Canberra and the rest in Sydney, which was great because by then all of my children had fairly significant chronic illnesses. And those 3 days in Canberra was the one time in my life where I was only doing one thing at a time. Sort of nice. Somewhere in there I did a PhD, which was just as well because when GPET fell over and GP training went over to the Department of Health, gave me that opportunity to work for a while as a bureaucrat and, you know, to see GP training through for a few years, and then I ended up at ANU. So I guess that's the very tortuous way around. Done lots of teaching, bit of research, bit of policy, bit of clinical practice. So I'm a true sort of generalist, really, I think.
Do you need to be a glutton for punishment to be a general practitioner these days?
Yeah, you do. I think we are now looking at some parallels, being candid. Medicine is a tribe.
Yep.
And what we know from our research in tribes is that we know that when abuse occurs in a tribe, that most humans, being social animals, will privilege the relationships over everything. And this is why I think general practitioners have put up with the systemic devaluing of their discipline for so long. I've actually been thinking of this, and intentional or not, it doesn't matter. I mean, we know that in domestic violence relationships, for instance, sometimes the perpetrators have good reason to be violent, but that doesn't matter. And I think we're in the same situation. I'm sure there's the best will in the world, but what we're in now is we have some of the same parallel processes. So, you know, we've got a situation where we've got financial coercive control, we've got scapegoating, we've got situations where we, you know, have had a look at recent media and ministerials, and most of the ministerials that say something like GPs are the cornerstone of the health system with either but or however, and then something that reduces GPs' agency. And I've realised that one of the reasons GPs stay is the same reason that a lot of mums will stay in domestic violence relationships, because they want to protect the more vulnerable people. We've always stepped in to protect our more vulnerable, which is the patients, of course, and we will bend over backwards to do that. But I think over the last 4 years, we can see a sequence of what I call a series of unfortunate events, you know, moments in time where GPs have realised, oh my goodness, the social contract is broken. We no longer can depend on them. So, for instance, the classic one was the time that we were classified as 1B because we weren't frontline workers. There was a time where, and we lost GPs, and then there was the next one when the government announced a major policy change that would affect us on Christmas Eve, and of course that led to another change. And there's been a series of those that have demonstrated to us that no matter what people think they believe, that actually we aren't valued in the health system.
There's no other profession that's asked to do things for nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, in some ways, I think the number of women growing has made a difference, because we do have the lady doctor problem. And of course, the lady doctor in a practice, the person who takes the lady doctor mantle isn't always a woman, but the lady doctor job, and there's always someone who does it, is that there's someone in the practice who does things because it's a vocation, because we care and we like to do things and it gives us a degree of personal satisfaction. Greg Hunt played into this. Minister Hunt announced one day, you know, GPs are the cornerstone of the health system and so on. And he actually said, GPs go into medicine because they want to help people. And this is why I'm asking them to go out into the community and find people who are vulnerable, who have not yet been vaccinated, which is really, well, it's unpaid labour for a start, but it's also a public health job. I mean, it might be possible if we had capitation, but we don't. That idea that we do it for the love of it. And a lot of female doctors get the, you know, I wouldn't want to waste Dr. Michael's time with my mental health, so I've come to you, which is probably why we have the 30% gender pay gap.
Yeah.
But also why we have the plummeting mental health of our female GP workforce, particularly in rural, because of the emotional cost. It's not the trauma, it's the unfixable trauma. It's the moral distress of sometimes I know what this patient needs and I am utterly unable to make it work.
That sense of helplessness, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got 9 months wait for a private bed for anorexia in Sydney.
Wow.
I can't hold a patient for that long with severe anorexia. I have to take them home in my head and worry myself sick. They're 18, they're 14, they're 15, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That is what is unbearable. It's not the medicine. Yeah, sure, we have hard patients, we all do. It's not the hours. People ask if I'm tired. Yes, of course we're tired, but it's the moral distress of not only not being able to do it, but being held responsible. So
every time we, by we I mean Insight, publish an article like the one you recently wrote, and we've done quite a few, you know, Gillian Farmer's writing a few for us and you are and other people as well. We always get a certain flavour of commenter. They're usually anonymous. Their comment is, look, GPs have just been too nice. Just harden up and charge what you're worth. Or if it's a story about gender equality or gender inequity, it's all about, oh, but women don't want to be surgeons. You know, maybe women just don't want to be surgeons. And you know, women want to have babies and they want to, you know, do that. So, of course, they're going to get paid less. They work less. How do you get through that ignorance of what GPs do and what female GPs particularly do? How do you battle that day in, day out?
Well, it's very hard. I remember having a medical student sit in with me once and I did a 40-minute consult with a woman who was giving her first disclosure of childhood trauma. Very hard consult, very delicate therapeutic relationship, you know, tiptoeing around trauma, trying not, and then bringing her back out of that trauma enough so that she could walk out to the waiting room and not feeling so raw and vulnerable. And I remember after she left, I turned to the student and I said, so what did you see happening going on there? What did you see me do? And he said, oh, you had a bit of a chat. And
yeah,
I realized, no shade on him at all. It's a bit like when I look at a piece of art. I've got no idea what I'm looking at. And to try to describe what I'm looking at takes an awful lot. And yet I think that often when people look at what we do, they think we're just being nice. I remember when I worked in the country with a man who was, you know, an extraordinary multidisciplinary proceduralist and a very lovely doctor who treated his patients excellently. And he came to a workshop of mine 7 years in, so we knew each other well. And I was doing something on mental health and he said, I had no idea there was any theory behind what you do. So
wow.
I think one of the issues with general practice is when I watch my husband repair a computer, he has to explain things in words of one syllable. Otherwise, I don't understand what he's doing. I don't have the learning to understand how complex what he's doing is. I think it's very hard to explain what GPs do. Often people blame us for not explaining it well enough, but, you know, Beach has been defunded. No one sits in with us to observe what we do. They use proxy variables that aren't proxy variables, like our billing behaviour.
Exactly.
One of the greatest mysteries in general practice is what happens during an item 23. I don't blame people for not valuing what we do because they don't know what we do. They don't see what we do. And ultimately, it wouldn't take me 14 years of training if it was simple enough for me to explain in a soundbite. However,
and yet everybody experiences general practice as a patient.
Ah, but they don't, do they? Because the people who talk are often the people who come to see me for just a script. Because the people who are overwhelmed and live a life of chaos and multi-morbidity and so on aren't writing into you. This is one of the problems I used to find in the Department of Health. I actually ended up taking photographs of my degrees and sticking them in a 9-piece photo frame behind my head because people would tell me, they would say, this is what a GP does. And I would say, no, that's, and they, oh, yes, it is. I don't think you understand general practice. Are you a specialist or just a GP?
How much damage did that campaign do? Just a GP.
A lot. But also the government plays into that narrative, I think, because we are convenient scapegoats. You know, we do have the, if general practice got its act together, we wouldn't have ambulance ramping, which of course is not true. The evidence says it's not true. But it is convenient to move that sideways onto a workforce that is scattered. Yeah. Because that way you don't have to face up to it's actually bad policy. You can put it down to it's bad apples. By preference, it's always easier to say it's bad apples. So I think there are two things that happen with these people who write in. The first one is that they are ignorant of what we do and they may never have experienced it. But the second thing is when you love your profession, we see this in abuse. So in my work on sexual abuse between doctors, you know, when John Kearsley, who was convicted of sexual assault of his registrar, he pleaded guilty and then got 100 testimonials saying what a wonderful man he was.
Yes.
And when I was trying to make sense of that, I think there is this thing that we know from the literature that says when you've been betrayed by your tribe, there is a psychological tendency to privilege the tribe and to say, oh, well, medicine's good. Medicine is fundamentally good. It must be good. And therefore, this person must be creating chaos. And I think GPs have worn that a bit. You know, yeah. Medicine's fine. It's just that these female doctors don't know how to bill is a classic story. At the same time as we have the government advertising that we should be bulk billing. And so that's fueling the community's expectations. And they do. They come in expecting. And now they come in telling us that they're not going to pay us because we're rotting.
But it's been an extraordinary year. I mean, apart from COVID, there's been, you know, there was the Stoush early this year with a small group of psychiatrists who shall remain unnamed. And then there was this Medicare rorts issue. It's all felt very directed, very organised. One of the things that baffles me about both of those instances is why and why now?
I think there's some powerful lobby groups around. And I think there's some powerful narratives that are very hard to overturn. So one of the issues we have about it being difficult to describe the complexity of what we do, it's easy to see, if you're a health economist, it's easy to see medicine as just a series of protocols, like cataracts. The patient has a cataract, you replace the lens, the patient gets better.
Yes.
So you measure the outcome. That's nice. General practice, of course, isn't like that. When do you measure the outcomes? What outcomes are you measuring? Which protocol do you want me to follow of the 15 that apply to this particular patient when they can't afford any of the evidence-based treatments? And the words evidence-based have become, I think, weaponized and used inappropriately. So we know, for instance, that the metrics are all developed on white urban blokes mostly. We then drag and drop those metrics into Broken Hill or Walgett expect that we can measure quality on the basis of those metrics with patients that bear no relationship to the ones where they were done. And I think it's a bit like saying, well, we learned this for liver disease, so this patient's got asthma, let's use those techniques. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
No.
But it is a seductive model because it means we can use less well-trained workers. If we see general practice as being essentially something simple, we can use better trained workers. What's more, if we give the more straightforward patients to lesser trained workers, they will do better on any metric than we will. And the more diversity, complexity we have in general practice, the worse the comparison between a GP outcome with a patient with, you know, an Aboriginal patient with diabetes and renal disease and everything else, and poverty and intersectional disprivilege. We compare their outcomes to the patient who gets into the fancy multidisciplinary diabetes clinic somewhere, we will do worse. Yep. So by definition, it is better for patients in general, think health economists, to be providing multidisciplinary teams.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Louise Stone, a GP, researcher and medical educator, about her path to general practice and the challenges of being a female Australian general practitioner. If you are interested in Louise's soon-to-be-published book about sexual abuse between doctors, visit ofdoctorsbydoctors.com for more information and the opportunity to help make the book open access. The full link is in the show notes for this podcast. Back to our chat. That's just not possible in 90% of settings.
No. Well, it's possible, but whether it achieves in Britain, we're seeing that that was mandated and we know that it had variable results. And in certain studies, we're seeing that multidisciplinary teams reduce satisfaction, increase cost, and increase accident and emergency presentations. Now, do I rely on multidisciplinary teams? Of course I do. I wouldn't work if I didn't. I've never worked without having wonderful nursing staff, wonderful psychologists, the whole bit. The issue is whether those teams should be fixed or bespoke. And I think it's often not recognised that almost all of my patients have a bespoke team. I think we're not talking about multidisciplinary teams. We're talking about co-located fixed multidisciplinary teams. And that only works if the patients have a lot of homogeneity, like diabetes, simple diabetes with nothing else. Then you'll get better outcomes. And the only way the whole system will improve is if you then invest the money you save from that to the patients who need complexity. But that never works because the patients with complexity are usually the ones who get the lowest investment in the health system, which is unfortunate.
So wave a magic wand, Louise. What would you do right now to fix things for general practitioners?
There's three things I would do. The first thing is we have no idea what all our health service changes are doing to equity. I would insist on everything we do being reported against equity measures, because at the moment I'm assuming from my experience that we're getting rid of patients. The more disprivileged they are, the less likely they are to get to services, but we don't necessarily have that evidence. So that's step one. Step two is that I think we need to have a community consultation, because at the moment we are using health service and economic levers to dissuade people from getting services. So we obviously, and no one says this, we need a bit of truth telling. We obviously can't provide best practice care for everyone. If we could, we wouldn't have ambulance ramping. My patient wouldn't be bleeding from miscarriage for 9 hours in a chair in accident and emergency. I mean, obviously, we can't provide best practice. So we've got two choices. We either provide less than best practice for everyone, or we decide not to serve certain groups. Mm. At the moment, it's unpalatable politically to say that we're not going to serve certain groups. So we do it by unintentionally, but we do it by making the services so complex that certain patients just don't get over the hurdles. Now, that means that you're most privileged. You know, I have a patient who saw 5 public orthopedic surgeons before she chose one for her hip replacement. Now, I have no problem with her making those choices, but I do have a problem with taxpayer funding when I can't get another patient in for their hip replacement. So we need to have a community discussion about how much of that choice we're going to truncate in order to pay good enough services on the ground. And I think everyone deserves a generalist. I think the third thing that I would say is that we have a lot of discussions about management, but we don't have much about diagnosis. And I think the safest strategy for patients is to have a generalist at the front of care. And we are the best trained diagnosticians. I have no qualms in saying my nurse does a better job of following certain protocols. She does a better job of immunisation than I will ever do. She's very good at what she does. But I know that when a patient comes in with medically unexplained symptoms, you want someone like me at the front end and, dare I say, followed up by a generalist physician somewhere along the line. And what that means is that should be available to everyone and should be funded appropriately. And quite frankly, we should be funding general practice to the point that that occurs. If we're going to take a free market approach, then we need to just go with a free market and say, at the current funding, we're losing GPs hand over fist and we'll be 11,000 of them short by 2030. That's unsustainable. We're going to have to fund them at the level that we're not 11,000.
Yeah.
What we do with locums. So I don't see what the problem is. So from my point of view, that's where I would sit.
I'm trying to work out where the government, the current federal government, sits in terms of believing the science, believing the evidence, and caring enough to put the money where it needs to be. Are you seeing any signs of encouragement that make you think things are going to get better?
You know who's giving me signs of encouragement?
Who?
Jason Clare, the education minister.
Yeah, why?
Jason Clare brought out a tweet that said, if we want a well-trained, capable workforce, we have to stop bagging teachers. So Jason Clare's approach is to say that we need to stop bagging teachers if we want to make a vibrant teaching workforce, and we need to train them appropriately. I struggle in general practice. You know, the North Queensland pharmacy trial is a case in point where the evidence didn't seem to swing the policy. And e-mental health is another one where we know that e-mental health is useful for a small cohort, but we haven't defined who that cohort is. And the dropout rate for many of the trials is 80%, 90%, which we would never accept for something like Ventolin, for instance, but we accept for this particular intervention. But it doesn't seem to swing the policy. So there are narratives that can't be swung. The narrative that people working top of scope can be a workforce replacement relies on this idea that somehow the patient will know whether or not they're big sick or little sick, that they'll be able to go, yeah, I've got a problem that is fine with the nurse. And sometimes that'll happen, sprained ankle, for instance. Yeah. Definitely nurse practitioners do that very well. But when they've got fatigue.
It could be anything,
Could be anything, you know. It's a different space. And I think this is the diagnosis versus management problem that we need diagnosticians at the front, because you will get surprises and you don't know what you don't know and unintentional.
And I think that's the bit of general practice people don't understand.
No, they don't. They really don't. And it's frustrating because it is this case where we'll see, you know, 999 flu-like illnesses will be flu and the other one will be something awful. And picking that one awful one, I mean, a GP picked up monkeypox, for goodness sake. I wouldn't blame them if they didn't, but I can't imagine anyone else in the health system that would be in a better position to pick it up. That's where we need to be. We need enough of us to be able to do that. But thinking that you can just roll us in to do the hard parts after other people have sorted out the easy parts fails to recognise this role in diagnosis of the rare, unusual, difficult space.
That looks simple. You know,
it looks simple. It does. Yeah. It looks simple. Or you don't see it at all. I did have a word. I got asked by an ABC reporter to comment on an article, and she said to me, what would you say to me about this article? And I had to think about it, and I said, well, can you think of any media in the last 5 years that said anything positive about general practice? Yeah. And she couldn't. And she said, oh, maybe the local papers. And I went, yes, but that'll be, you know, our Dr. Henry is better than all those other doctors. And I said, the last positive thing I can remember being said about doctors was the Thai cave rescue. So there is this enormous pushback and scapegoating, and people are frustrated with COVID, and I think it's landed very hard on general practice. And you know how I know? When the National Pharmacy Day came up, there's a 20-minute video made by the Prime Minister, the Minister for Health, and every single Premier on how marvellous pharmacists are. World Family Doctor Day, it's crickets. And I asked one of the ministers and said, what's that about? Oh, well, we don't lobby hard enough. And I thought, is that what it takes to be seen? Is that what we need to do? And I think that's incredibly sad, that it seems obvious to me that we've got a very demoralised, sad, sometimes quite mentally unwell workforce. We've got practices closing everywhere.
Yeah.
We've got people just quiet quitting all over Australia.
Are you tempted to give it away, Louise?
Oh, of course. I'm 57 and I know that I won't stay in clinical practice forever, but I love my job and I love the mix. I've never worked in one. I couldn't work 5 days a week in clinical practice because of the work I do, because I do so much complex mental health. I've always had policy or research or teaching or something on the side. I don't think I will give away general practice in the rest of my career, but I think as I age, there will come a time when clinical practice fades and I'll be doing more teaching and policy. But of course. Of course. And yeah. I think if I was starting again, I think I would have a good hard think.
Interesting. So what do you say to your med students?
I say that the wheel turns because I do think the wheel turns. And, you know, we know in general practice we lurch between GPs aren't trained enough to do accident and emergency and need to get out of our hospital to GPs are the cornerstone of the accident and emergency system, depending on workforce. Mm-hmm. That's what happened in obstetrics. At times we GPs are critical to the workforce and at other times we're irrelevant. So, you know, I'm sure it will happen again. But as you said earlier about evidence, I can't understand. We know we're the cheapest. We use 7% of the Medicare budget and we know we achieve good outcomes. The fact that we can't itemize that or atomize that into aliquots that are understandable by the health economists. If it was understandable by the health economists, you wouldn't need me to do 14 years of training. But because exactly. We can't do that, we still get very good outcomes. That evidence just doesn't seem to penetrate. I think it's very sad that they're looking at, in many cases, replacing something or atomizing it or taking pieces out of it.
Yeah.
And assuming that general practice will do what I call sweeping up after the parade, you know, the primary care partialists who only do a small part will take the simple patients away and leave us with the complexity with the same degree of funding, which is
exactly,
just unsustainable.
Just hopeless.
We wouldn't be in general practice if we didn't believe in social justice. There are a group of doctors who believe in social justice, and I think that's the biggest loss to the workforce. We don't mind in many ways. We do in some ways, but we will not be driven out of the profession by bankruptcy. We know that. We won't be driven out by tiredness. We know that. But we will by moral distress. When I cannot bulk bill my patients who are adolescents sleeping in cars, I can't bear that. Something that I cannot do. And to put that onto us is, you know, we just had the seniors card announcement. It said, you know, and your GP is encouraged to bulk bill a seniors card. You know, seniors can get a seniors card if they earn, I think it's under $90,000, which is about the same wage as a first year GP registrar. So are we asking the GP registrar who earns less than the person with the seniors card to donate the $43 gap between the cost of care and the Medicare rebate? And the answer is yes, we are.
Yeah.
We're creating that expectation. And, you know, that is, I think, a real indictment. And I don't think our response, which has been to see if we can allocate things across a team, the teams are important, but they're not going to replace that generalist perspective. I often have this conversation about how big does a multidisciplinary team have to be before it's more effective and more efficient to use a generalist, because every time you bring in a new person, you increase the number of communication channels there are and you increase the number of communication drops or, you know, contraindications or...
And confusion for the patient.
...or whatever it is. And you dilute the therapeutic relationship. And there comes a point at which when a person's got more than 2-3 diseases, where their entire career is going around different experts and their disease becomes their job, not just for them but also for their carer. When does the gains of getting the expert diabetes educator outweigh the loss of this poor person having to fund driving into the hospital, waiting in the waiting room with the carer who can't work because they're driving their person around? When does that benefit outweigh that risk? And I think we're not looking at that as a value equation, and we should.
So last thing, how's the book? What's happening with the book? Tell us about the book.
8 years of work with 63 authors from 23 countries. I'm very proud. I must say, starting a book on sexual abuse between doctors just before the pandemic and having authors from all over the country who just kept dropping out saying, I'm sorry, but I run intensive care in Pakistan, and me saying, well, of course you're busy. So it arose from my own my own interaction with a young doctor who'd been sexually abused by another doctor, and realizing that this was happening all over the world, and realizing that we were really doing simple solutions to a very complex problem. It's not just something that needs a little bit of light education, or even worse, young doctors just need to toughen up and report. We have inputs from all sorts of disciplines. So bringing together international experts from medical regulation and law and policy, and it's been huge. I'm very proud of being able to bring in people who have expertise from countries like Iran, for instance, or Egypt. I think we've learned a lot bringing that all together, but it's a bit like herding cats. So we're hoping the book will be published next October. We're hoping to run a symposium in March.
Great.
And I always think it's quite funny. It's a bit like anything that women lead, I think, where we're holding the equivalent of a cake stall by setting up a GoFundMe site so that we can make the thing open access so that the authors can publish in their original languages.
Great.
And can actually have this book available to people who can't afford to buy it, like medical students or people in developing countries.
So what's it called?
Yeah, that's debatable at the moment because apparently he doesn't like my title, but the one on the website has been Beyond Zero Tolerance, because I think everyone says we've got a zero tolerance approach, which of course never works.
Yep.
So at the moment we're using that title, but it'll have something after the colon that says something like, you know, international experiences and responses to sexual harassment between doctors, but we're not quite sure what the form of words will take.
And where can people go to, where's the GoFundMe?
Ofdoctorsbydoctors.com is the name of the site that has all the information about the book and some ideas about where all the authors are and those sorts of things, and the link to the GoFundMe. So
excellent. Well, very happy to give that a plug.
No cardiologist will ever have to GoFundMe their book on atrial fibrillation, trust me.
No, they won't, sadly. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts, or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.